Pennsylvania, and those legislators who want to try to pretend that, you know, that vouchers are going to sell the day are going to find out that it's a losing battle.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Helen Ginn, Philadelphia City Council member, and Kendra Brooks with Parents United in Our Cities, Our Schools. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gaddis, Dina Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio and Chamber Music Northwest have been working together for over 40 years to bring diverse music to the community and to underserved populations, and we are working together in the Give Guide. There are opportunities for tickets to Christian Tetzloff's performance of Bach's solo violin works and other thank you gifts. More information is available at kboo.fm/cmnw2017.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland.
Till she breaks, and we bleed for less. How much is enough? I remember listening to songs of the sun for all those whose breath was stolen, whose lives were taken away, who learned too late. And now we sing again to the house of the dawn. That can right this wrong. And now this land breathes pain. Now nothing grows that doesn't carry the trauma that we weep, that you sow. And now we sing again to the house of the dawn. Now there are no words that can right this wrong. Same power of blood and bones, of poison stolen homes, of genocide mutilated ghosts, fierce hearts buried.
Good morning. Welcome once again to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. We have back in the studio with us after many months, my regular monthly co-host guest, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. And Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in this morning. I know you have a hard time bucking that morning traffic to get in here. So you're usually on the phone, but our phone lines are down. So the only way we could get you on was for you to come in. So we thank you very much.
I'm happy to be here.
And so that means that there will be no call-ins this morning. We've had a problem with our phones since Friday. So you just heard a Klee Benali, Song of the Sun, from Respect Existence or Expect Resistance, his CD, which was out, I believe, last year or earlier this year. And he, of course, is Dene, half Dene Navajo, like my guest host here, Jacqueline Keeler, and they know each other. And he has a chapter in your book, Edge of Mourning, which we're going to be talking about, along with the whole bear's ears controversy that President Trump, along with his other disgraceful acts, slashed dramatically in a unilateral act, which whose legality will be adjudicated in the upcoming months and years. He talks in this song about leave it in the ground. And of course, uranium mining is a big issue around the bear's ears. And of course, historically, that the Dene people have had to deal with. So Klee Benali, talk a little bit about Klee.
Yeah, he's a Navajo activist, and he's featured in the second third of my book, Edge of Mourning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears. And I really wanted to highlight the ways in which Navajo people have been fighting for the land, not just at Bear's Ears, but around the Navajo Nation. And the uranium issue is a huge issue, and there are over 500 unmitigated mines on the Navajo Nation.
I think Jackie told me earlier that she would have to cut out briefly. She's got an interview, important press interview to do. That might be what she's looking at.
No, let's see.
No, I guess not.
Yet. Not yet. I'll let you know.
Anyway.
But yeah, it's my latest article in High Country News about the bear's ears. I think it's called Trump Tells Tribes to Let Them Eat Yellow Cake, because sort of an underreported element of the reduction of the Bear's Ears National Monument is the fact that the role that a uranium company played in it, and the role that uranium mining plays in general in creating toxic environments for Native communities.
The company involved is Energy Fuels Resources USA, a subsidiary of a Canadian firm, which I'm reading. I know you wrote an article about it as well that you just mentioned, but it came out in the Post just a few days ago. Uranium firm urged Trump officials to shrink Bear's Ears National Monument. See, so you know, you were involved in this process. You wrote an essay for a book called Red Rock Stories: Three Generations of Writers Speak on Behalf of Utah's Public Lands, which came out a year and a half ago, and which was delivered to every member of the U.S. Congress in June of last year as part of this whole effort. So you yourself have been involved in this, and you know a lot of the principals. You have talked to them, you interviewed them for your book, Edge of Mourning. This must have been, I don't know what you'd call it, a huge shock, disappointment, although it was certainly, I guess, announced in advance that Trump was likely to do this.
Yeah, the main issue, I think, at hand with Bear's Ears is the issue of what is the best use of the land. And certainly Mormon descendants of Mormon settlers, colonists to San Juan County, where Bear's Ears is located in southeastern Utah. I should mention that San Juan County is the size of New Jersey. It's huge. Bear's Ears was 1.3 million acres, about 40% of the county. And so it has never been an area that it wasn't settled in the way that many places are settled in the sense that the pioneers went because they thought there was actually something they could make a living there. They were actually directed to go there by the Mormon Church. What the Mormon Church would do is they would actually just read a list of people's names out and say, you all are now selling all your things and you're moving to this place. And they were basically put there as placeholders for sovereignty for the Mormon Church. So when the church went and met with the U.S. government, they'd be able to draw the line broader, where they a wider area, surface area, whereby they could control and have jurisdiction. And so this is before the U.S. had, before the state of Utah was created. And so in the process of that, Native nations have been living there. The Bears Ears has over 100,000 archaeological sites, particularly in Cedar Mesa, which actually was part of the area that was excluded from the monument by Trump's announcement in his proclamation. And they were forcibly removed when it became for white settlement. And now they're using that, Utah Republicans are using that as an excuse to say that Native nations don't have a place at the table, and that it's a state thing, it's a county thing, and ignoring, 12,000 years of human occupation of the area that is directly tied to the cultures of the Navajo Nation, the Ute people, both Ute Mountain Ute and the Ute tribe, and also of the Zuni Nation and also the Hopi Nation. And so it's... they try to draw the circle as tight as possible, who can sit at the table, who they want at the table to control these resources. And so there was never, it was never really a profitable place to live if profit is your motive, as it is in colonialism. But it was a place that nurtured Native nations. It's the birthplace of, five different Native nations. It is, Bears Ears is, which is named for the two twin buttes. They're located, they're shaped like bear's ears in Navajo Shuscha. And so they, although the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, and this monument proposal was the product of several years' work by these different five Native nations together. This is national policy for these nations.
I read that this is perhaps the first time in U.S. history that like Native nations have led, basically led the whole process towards creating a new federal public lands.
Yes, it is, and it's and also it represents a huge step forward in their management of it. They have, the way they wrote the proposal, they have co-management of the monument. And this is something that has actually been altered in Trump's proclamation, which is that now they will only have the Bears Ears Commission, as it's called, which has representatives from each of the five nations and the federal government, has a narrower scope now, only the area which he has called Shasta, and also he's added a county representative who happens to be Navajo, but she opposes the monument, and she's a minority. Only they did in the last 2 months, the different chapter houses, Navajos organized themselves as chapter houses. That's our town hall kind of situation, and they all voted, all the chapter houses in Utah, there are seven of them. All of them, except for Aneth, which is the one she comes from, which would not allow a vote. 98% of the Navajos living in the Utah area support Bears Ears National Monument. She represents a tiny minority, and she also has financial ties to the oil and gas industry. Her son oversees the Aneth oil and gas royalties, and so she's very tied into the Mormon Church and that whole thing. And so she does not reflect the policies of the Navajo Nation or the majority of other Navajos living in that area. She was handpicked by Trump to be a disruptive force. And also equating a county, she's not a tribal leader, she's a state county, she's a county representative. To equate a representative of a county to a representative of nations is really part of Trump's embracing of this whole Bundy extremism, whereby the county is the supreme law of the land, the sheriff is the most powerful person in the world, and really falls in line with the Bundy's attorneys, Karen Bud Fallon's whole county supremacy ideology. And she is actually under consideration to lead the Bureau of Land Management by Trump.
That's a lot to take in. Let's step back just a second. Okay, so the Bears Ears was created as a national monument by Obama last year or earlier this year? Last year.
Yeah, October, December, just before he got out of office.
That's right, December, just before he got out of office. Okay, it was a 1.3 million acres. And as you were talking about, this incredible process that maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of it. It obviously goes back years. It's not something that was just sort of put out there on the table and then Obama rubber stamped it. It was something that's been a long time in the making with tremendous participation officially by the Native nations involved that you mentioned. And then Trump, just 2 Mondays ago, announced he was reducing the national monument by 85% to 201,876 acres. Now you, as we said, you contribute a chapter to this Red Rock Stories, and you edited Edge of Morning Native Voices Speak for the Barriers, which you just talked about. You also wrote a number of articles relating to this issue, and now you've written a series of three articles, the first of which was Hey Trump, Navajo Elders Aren't Your Political Props. The second, Let Them Eat Yellow Cake About the Uranium. And the third one, I guess, just come out.
Oh, I wrote another one for Crosscut, which hasn't come out yet. But about what is the best use of the land. I was quite shocked to see that Trump had used a Navajo elder again as sort of a fig leaf for a white male, greed. The previous week, he had used Navajo, a moment when he was supposed to be honoring Navajo code talkers to take a political swipe at Elizabeth Warren. And I wrote a piece for Yes Magazine there, too, about how Pocahontas is not a slur. Her name is not a slur. Her name is a testament and should be said in memory of all the missing and murdered Indigenous women that have been lost to colonialism, for the last 500 years, and that the next time Elizabeth Warren, this was like the 26th time she'd been called Pocahontas by Trump. The next time he did that, she should bring up the name. She should name the name of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and I suggested she mention Olivia Lone Bear, who has been missing for over 40 days in North Dakota, and the police won't act upon it because they claim that she just disappeared without telling her family and her children, without any money, without her wallet, without her phone, without her car, and without her jacket even, just disappeared one day, and there's no crime scene, so there's no crime. And the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women is particularly important in North Dakota with the man camps. On her reservation, it's over 1 million acres, and these man camps can be anywhere, and they basically are fracking workers, fracking the land, and have a documented history of abducting tribal members and molesting and raping them and killing them. So, and there's very little jurisdiction over that. Anyway, I have to go now.
Okay, so, I've been speaking with Jacqueline Keeler. She's a Yankton Dakota and Diné or Navajo heritage, and she has just taken a media break. She has to do an important interview that she can't that had been scheduled, so she'll be back in just a few minutes. My name's Paul Rowan. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We apologize that we can't do the call-in portion of Talk Radio because our phone lines are down. I'm not exactly sure what the issue is. I think it has something to do with the old wiring. It's an old phone system, been planning to be updated for quite a while. Maybe this will give it a heavy shove in that direction. And we do appreciate your listening in and beg your forbearance not being able to talk directly to Jacqueline Keeler, who has so much important things to say. We're going to probably talk a little bit more about this whole issue of Native women. I wanted to ask her about her views, her take on the whole Me Too movement and the women speaking up against abuse, harassment. Of course, the whole issue of the treatment of Indigenous women under historically and currently under the colonial system is something that never gets quite enough attention. And I know Jacqueline has a lot to say about that. So we'll be here until 9 o'clock when Political Perspectives comes your way. And as I said, she wrote these three articles. One, Hey Trump, Navajo Elders Aren't Your Political Props. The other one, Let Them Eat Yellow Cake, about the whole issue of uranium mining, which, as I said, also appeared in the Washington Post December 8th. I'll just read a little bit of that while we wait for Jackie to come back. A uranium company launched a concerted lobbying campaign to scale back Bears Ears National Monument, saying such action would give it easier access to the area's uranium deposits and help it operate a nearby processing mill, which is actually just outside the original Bears Ears National Monument designated area. According to documents obtained by the Washington Post, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and top Utah Republicans have said repeatedly that questions of mining or drilling played no role in President Trump's announcement Monday that he was cutting the site by more than 1.1 million acres, or 85%. Trump also signed a proclamation nearly halving the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which also is in southern Utah and has significant coal deposits. And we welcome Jackie back. Thank you.
Hi.
So yeah, I was just talking a little more about the uranium mine, but let's go a little bit more into this whole absurd Trumpism, this feud he has with Elizabeth Warren. There's many aspects to it. I wanted you to weigh in on Me Too and how that relates, how you view that from an indigenous perspective, but. You know, the whole issue of Elizabeth Warren's claims to Cherokee ancestry, which I've been looking into, which is what, why for some reason he calls her Pocahontas, which obviously is a complete non sequitur since Pocahontas had nothing to do with the Cherokees. But leaving that aside, let's just talk for a minute, because I know you've talked a lot about the whole pretend Indian phenomenon.
Pretend Indianism.
But I've looked into the whole issue of Elizabeth Warren. It seems like it's a complicated thing. It to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like she hasn't made really that strong a claims about it. Maybe I'm wrong. There's a lot of issues about whether she gained any professional advantage from it. At least one article I read said that she's never claimed it on any, job application or anything. Talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, I don't want to give it more credence than it deserves. I mean, I think that as far as I understand, the Cherokee people feel insulted. And that's probably the most important thing about it, is it how the Cherokee Nation, how members of the Cherokee Nation perceive it. I mean, I really feel for the Cherokee people, because can you imagine, when you tell someone you're Cherokee or what your nationality is, and they look at you like as if, oh, are you really? I mean, I certainly don't get that as a citizen of the Navajo Nation. People don't pretend to be Navajo that often. But it is just so endemic and really corrosive to the identity of the Cherokee people. This is the case for them. And so I respect their feelings about it. And whenever I post anything positive about Elizabeth Warren on my social media, I immediately get bombarded with Cherokees going, they're so angry at her for what she did. And so
she is a person to respect. It's unfortunate that
it has
to be this
cloud. That's often the experience being a native person, is that, I would love to be all behind Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and yet she was, in 2005, she invoked the Doctrine of Discovery in a case, which is basically says that Native people don't have legal right to their land because they are not Christian, and not a member of a discovering nation. So it's one of those difficult things about being indigenous in a country that denies your rights. And so what I recommended in my book, I don't know if you read my article in Yes Magazine, Pocahontas is not a name that should offend you, but I do suggest at the end that she apologize formally to the Cherokee Nation. And I think, as someone who is a diplomat, someone whose role it is to conduct themselves in international affairs, respecting the feelings of the Cherokee Nation should be no big deal for her. I think it should be something that she should do graciously and thereby gain an ally. I think, and in this fight with Trump, I think, and the Cherokee people would be very grateful if she took a stand on that and addressed it in a coherent way. So that's my feeling on that. I think it's definitely respecting the sovereignty of Native nations, not trying to appropriate Native identity for personal gain or for just personal feel-good moments is not appropriate, you know. And so we should, I think that's, I actually am, when I get done with my next book, I'm definitely going to work on a very coherent essay on what Indigenous identity is, you know, steps we can take to basically solidify it, because I do believe the lack of solidity of Native identity is one of the reasons Native youth have such high rates of despair and suicide. I think that, and this has been U.S. policy to basically make it fuzzy, make our identity politically fuzzy, because it's so threatening, because our nations have prior claims to land.
So, thank you for that. So the issue, again, which you had started to talk about before you had to take a short break there, of missing Indigenous women, and as I mentioned while you were gone, the historic and current abuse of Native women in a colonial system, which was just still is vicious in some parts of the country, is attenuated. Seems like since the times of just all out rape, kidnapping, and that happened in the initial colonial period. But talk a little bit about your perspective on this, on the Me Too, this amazing moment in time right now.
Yeah, I think you're making a connection to what happened with Roy Moore's defeat in Alabama. And yeah, I think it was very interesting. What I try to draw connections with in my work is the connections between colonialism and these abuse of the land, of the people. And certainly when you look at Trump and you look at and Moore and his ilk, you see people who are just engorged with power, with the delight of power. And I think a lot of what we're dealing with are issues about power, you know. And so definitely the most powerless are the ones who are most victimized, you know. And certainly Native women are still victimized at a much higher rate than the rest of the population. The Department of Justice, I think in 2010, released a study that found that Native women have experienced rape and murder at nearly three times the rate of other American women. And in some counties, nine times the rate of murder. So an extremely high rate. And also, unusually, according to this study, 70% of the assaults on Native women are not done by Native men. They're done by mostly white men.
And that was done with impunity in a lot of places, but especially because
there's a jurisdiction
huge
gap.
Jurisdictional gap.
Yeah, there's a gap in the jurisdiction caused by U.S. meddling and in Native lands. We have this thing called the Five Major Crime Acts, in which, you know, Native nations do not have jurisdiction over. It has to go to the federal, and the FBI has to. But the FBI declines to investigate like 70% of cases on the reservation. So that means that, and this is known supposedly, like in non-Native men can go to the reservations and get away literally with murder and rape and not be actually tried. I think there's. This is the case particularly where I was talking about with Olivia Lone Bear, where her reservation has intersection of five different counties. So five different counties have jurisdiction and her tribe. And there was the Violence Against Women's Act was passed in 2013. And one of the things that held it up for 2 years was an amendment that would give tribes oversight over non-natives for domestic violence. And the Republicans fought this tooth and nail, and it finally passed, but with the help of Bernie Sanders, I should say, and Senator Sanders. And so there is a slow rollout going on of tribes having jurisdiction for the first time over non-federally enrolled tribal members. And so this will hopefully help fill the gap with actual prosecution.
Now I would be remiss in not mentioning another popular culture a phenomenon that relates to this, which is the film Wind River. You're talking about North Dakota. You talked about these man camps. Just give us your thumbnail view of that movie and how it relates to this.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen the movie yet, I have to be honest. And I do recommend reading Jennifer Dennett Dale's review of it. She's a Navajo scholar who unfortunately didn't have time to contribute to my book, but I really recommend her work.
Her name again?
Jennifer Dennett Dale. And she wrote a very good review of it, which...
I'll link to that. I have a number of your articles linked on the program page at kboo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. I will get that from you. I'll link also to that article.
Yeah. So I think, the connection between power and abuse, and which is really what... I often say that Trump is... I give this lecture about how the United States is still the colony, in function, if not in form or, in name. I think... And Trump is the ultimate colonial leader, the Bundys and Trump, they're all espousing a view of Trump has his energy dominance doctrine, which is something I talk about in my article in High Country News, Let Them Eat Yellow Cake. And certainly even Zinke has gave a speech between the in front of the Heritage Foundation in September, basically espousing, the energy doctrine, the energy dominance doctrine, in the sense that not only is the U.S. going to be energy self-sufficient or energy secure, but also energy dominant over the world. And this means mining. This means complete access to all the resources of the land possible. And really, this is, I think, what the reduction of Bears Ears is really about, is to be able to have the right to use the resources with impunity, with no oversight, and with the full engorged vigor of the victor, and this really is what we are up against. What the fight is about. So I think and looking at the issue of uranium in Indian Country and uranium poisoning, which I bring up in my article, I have personal experience with that. I was telling you the last time I saw Cleve Benali we were at a conference in Moab, Utah, in October, and he had just come from visiting my uncle's house on the Navajo Reservation, just near the south rim of the Grand Canyon, and that area has a lot of open abandoned uranium mines that have not been mitigated, and there's three right near my grandparents' house. And so Clee went out. He had gotten a bunch of Navajos, Geiger counters, and they went out and took readings and of one near my. And even before they got to the mine, they said the readings were off. They maxed out their Geiger counters, I think at 9.99 microsieverts, which is in 1 second. And a cumulative dose for an entire day, you're talking, Fukushima levels. I mean, these are high levels of radiation. And
so your relatives have been living with this?
Yes, they live there. My uncle has a garden not far from there. And so I opened my article saying that, that uranium is in our bones. It's in our genes, even. It's affected Navajo genes and in our genomes. And it's they say that it's going to take 100 years to clean up these 500 plus mines. Only one has been cleaned up, and it will cost between $4 and $6 billion. And there is one abandoned uranium mine every 54 square miles on the Navajo Nation. The Navajo Nation is the size of Ireland, and basically they're taking one of the most culturally intact Native nations left in the country. We're talking 350,000 members, 170,000 of whom live on the reservation, who speak their language fluently, and they're basically condemning them to death, to early death through cancer. And we don't know. A recent study found that that Navajo people who live with close to abandoned uranium mines have more uranium in their bones than 95% of the U.S. population. And they found that Navajo babies pee urine, and they don't even know what that means as far as medically, with the long-term things. So talking about opening more uranium mines, because that's all there is on Bears Ears. all that's in, there are no oil or all of that was excluded from the monument boundaries.
As far as things that can be mined. Made money out of.
Yes, yeah. And so when they're talking about
other than the artifacts which people
yes,
have been looting
and yeah and but I mean they're all when he's talking about this there all there are uranium mines to be developed and there is very little cleanup that's happened in the past and where is the $4 to $6 billion to clean up the mines that they've already done and this doesn't even include the impact of the mill at White Mesa. The Ute Mountain Ute community of White Mesa has a uranium mill just a couple miles away. This is half that community speaks their language. There are only 900 speakers of their language left in the world, and they're being hit with the uranium ore is piled around the mill and it blows in the wind, and also there are many other toxic elements being released into they have these 250-acre ponds filled with uranium tailing waste and other toxic chemical waste, and this mill has not been certified for 10 years. It's been acting without a license for 10 years.
And this is the company that.
Go ahead.
What's the Energy Fuels Resources.
And actually, the Washington Post recently reported on Friday that that company actually was lobbying the Interior Department and actually spent quite a bit of money lobbying them. And they explicitly say in their letter, their CEO sent a letter to the Interior saying that their reason for wanting the reduction of Bear's Ears was because of the threat it posed to their uranium mill and their uranium mine, which is located, each of them are on opposite sides of the boundaries as drawn by President Obama. And also the state of Utah issued a 49-page comment during the comment period that Zinke had, the very short comment period, in which they said the main reason they wanted Bear's Ears reduced was because of the threat it posed to the uranium industry in Utah.
Well, that pretty much says it all. Well, you know, this is often overwhelming stuff. You know, ever since I got out west, the whole issue of uranium and the Navajo people is. I sort of got involved in the Big Mountain issue when I first got out here in 1985, and the Broken Rainbow was a slideshow that was shown at the time, talking about the relationship of uranium interest to the whole relocation of Navajo people and Hopis at the time, and just the Rio Puerco, the huge tailings mill pond spill that happened and that never
that was the largest spill in the country, larger than Five Mile Island, and yet is very it is not really well
known.
Three Mile Island, and but it yeah, I mean, basically this is genocide once again at this scale. What else could it be? You know, and yet has very little public attention or knowledge. And, I think, and so what Trump is actually, you know, by siding with the mining companies and espousing this totally energy dominance doctrine, he is going to bring more harm to Native communities. And certainly we see that, you know, with the uranium mines in the Southwest. There's also uranium mines in South Dakota, I should say, and even on Standing Rock. I spoke to some folks who have, you know, as children, they were born without fingers on the Standing Rock Reservation because of the uranium mine poisoning in the southwest part of the reservation in South Dakota. And of course, you know, the mining, the fracking and the tar sands, all of the harm it has caused to those communities, particularly with the man camps and with the toxic outcomes for those communities.
So once you get into this deeply, it does, as I said, seem kind of overwhelming and almost hopeless sometimes, and I'm just amazed. There's all this. I certainly have felt rather overwhelmed since Trump's election. I know there's a whole almost clinical characterization of people who have been feeling the effects, the emotional, mental effects of that, And certainly, you know, the reversal, the sudden reversal of the Standing Rock movement, which, you know, snatching victory from this incredible movement that developed. My feeling is just, you know, I've been around Native struggles and issues for quite a while, and I don't know, maybe I'm just getting older, but I'm just amazed how people keep on, you know, how activists like Clee Benally, how people in the face, you know, it's like we're all sort of dimly aware of it, but it's really so directly in the face of Native people, Indigenous people, the you know, living with the history itself, and then the continuing assaults, well, one after the other. It's just the spiritual resilience.
I think that one of the things I really look at in my writing, and particularly I'm really delineating in my next book, Standoff, is are the differences, the differences in the origin stories of Indigenous people and colonists. And I don't generally call, I don't use the word settler colonialism, because I think that's giving them too much credit. They don't settle, not really. Colonialism is strictly about consumption. And so I, you know, we look at the history of the United States, and of course, when I was covering the Keystone XL pipeline, I in 2013 and 2015, I interviewed a lot of Nebraska and South Dakota farmers, many of them white Republicans, and they were completely shocked at the fact that the U.S. government had given TransCanada, a corporation, governmental powers of eminent domain. This flew counter to their idea of what America was supposed to be. Yet I was actually sort of shocked, because they did not seem to know the history of their own country, in that many of the colonies, they began as basically joint stock companies. The financial needs of colonialism drove the creation of modern capitalism. You know, the crown could not afford to pursue colonialism on its own. They had to turn to their subjects, and the subjects pooled their money together to create these joint stock companies. And one of them, of course, was the Virginia colony, which began the colony of Virginia. Of course, we were talking about Pocahontas earlier, and one of the reasons she was kidnapped, right, was because the colonists, some of them, of course, indentured servants, they not only had to try to survive, but they also had to turn a profit for their investors in London, right? So to turn a profit, they then kidnapped her to basically negotiate better trade deals and things like that. So the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, the profit motive, the corporate origins of the United States, those are all one story. And the issue with Indigenous people is that and I use a definition that I got from my mom, my grandmother's cousin, Vine Deloria Jr., who was a Standing Rock Sioux tribal member and also a historian. He gives to define a people, an Indigenous people. And we often call ourselves the people, like Diné in Navajo means the people, right? And he says the people, on the other hand, have an origin story that begins with their meeting with a spiritual being that is a manifestation of the land itself, right? And then in this meeting, we are given rules of how to live on the land. We have to, it's not that we are just there to, we are not given complete dominion. Providence does not give us dominion over the land. What we have is we have a relationship to the land and to its people, its other people, which include, you know, in the case of the Dakota people, the Buffalo Nation. When we arrived on the Great Plains and were met by the white buffalo calf woman, we were given the pipe, we were given the rules, how we were to live on there, and how we respect the other people already on the land. That means the green growing things, the winged ones, the four-leggeds. And so this is the difference. This is why Indigenous people have answers that no one else has, because this relationship of mutual respect builds different outcomes than strict profit motive, which of course we are seeing the outcomes of that today, which include climate change and apparently atomic war or nuclear war, so it's and toxic poisoning of the land. I think these are the fundamental issues of our age, really, and the fight or the between colonialism, which Trump represents, and those who want to turn public lands into private profit, and Indigenous people. This is why Indigenous people are the focal point, because we have a different, this mutual relationship of respect is something that it could actually have a lot of answers to how to change this around.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this question from, you know, from a whatever I might be called, a colonial descendant, immigrant colonial descendant. The whole issue of a frame of reference, because we're also caught, you know, even like the constitutional structure I've mentioned a lot of time on this show really incorporates those colonial dynamics, and the idea that we can, you know, these very deep, difficult questions that we need to address, to the extent that we can actually deal with the legacy of this colonial system within the structure and framework. So, you know, I feel like I've been fortunate and privileged to actually have experienced something of, you know, this is a very sensitive thing to talk about, but, you know, something of an Indigenous reality. You know, I've participated to some extent, you know, certainly in meetings, in important, you know, meetings with people on the Columbia River. I've read the treaties. I've been to important gatherings, even some ceremonial gatherings, and I've seen a different way of relating through that. And I've been, you know, taken to places, places on the Columbia River, historical places, and seen to some extent through Indigenous eyes. Obviously, I can't completely do it, but so it's really difficult to step out of the frame of reference that you're brought up in, the colonial frame of reference. So yeah, I always, you know, took the lead from Indigenous people in terms of, you know, I got involved in the Nestle issue, which thank goodness we won, where, you know, it was a sacred spring on the Columbia River was under threat by the Nestle Corporation. They wanted to bottle the water. And, you know, I did what I could to help out there. And, you know, and I always took the lead from, like, the traditional chiefs on the river in terms of various issues, you know, fishing rights issues and other issues. So, yeah, I always saw that. And it was heartening to me, you know, when I came back from my long sojourn in my father's Indigenous territory, Italy, and to see the Standing Rock issue, and to see that there had been some, I guess my point is, it seems like there has been, despite all this terrible stuff that's continued and goes on, there seems to have been a certain development of awareness, especially through things like Standing Rock, through things like the Nessie issue. Seems like there's sort of a fragile coalition that seems to be emerging, a greater awareness among certainly younger activists and even older activists who get involved. Do you see that, you know, through Standing Rock, at least something started to develop? I know you have a real critique also of the way that a lot of the, you know, a lot of the white activist groups were conducting themselves in there, but do you see anything like that happening?
Yeah, of course I do. I think that Standing Rock was an amazing moment. I think it wasn't something that we expected to happen in our lifetime, and I think it has great promise. Actually, my next book is comparing the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock, and I really see Standing Rock as a real counter to the colonial the colonialism that Trump and his followers represent, which is a big chunk of America when you consider that 30% of voters are hardcore Trump supporters. Nothing can move them. And really is tied to the ideology of white supremacy. And I think you saw that play out in Roy Moore's loss or almost win. I mean, it was very, very close. And you look at the voter breakdown by race, and, you know, fully over 70% of the white voters were voted for Roy Moore. And then you see the exact 90% of African American voters.
98% of African American women.
Yeah, voted for Doug Jones. And so it's obviously, what is the difference between these two groups? It's that one has the blinders of white supremacy on and are unable to make good choices. They are actually, I think that white supremacy is a terrible social construct that grew out of Virginia colonialism, the Virginia colony, you know, and is actually, this is not even an exaggeration, could actually bring about the end of the world. I mean, with the belligerence with North Korea, you know, with the ignoring of, the Paris Agreement, all of these things.
Climate change. Yeah.
Climate change. It's and of course, you know, with the continued ignoring of the great harm that white supremacy does to many people in this country, simply because they do not fit a certain phenotype. It's pretty horrific, you know. I mean, Trump's family have only been here for 100 years or so in this country. They are not historically American. They didn't participate in the Civil War. They were in Europe still. Yet they feel fully entitled to all the benefits of being American because they are white, you know. And what that really says a lot there. I mean, I think only one of his uncles ever served in any war. You know, here he is belittling the work of the Navajo code talkers, you know, and I write in my book, my article about that, how, you know, now my great uncle Jefferson, you know, he's a Navajo, traditional Navajo. His first time going to Europe was basically landing on D-Day, Normandy, and he had to basically wade through the blood of his friends to get to Europe. And, you know, I think when you look at that sort of heroism and you look at Trump, you know, there's no comparison. I mean, you know, this is, and here they are voting for someone who is, you know, who is so horrific. And it just shows that the real issue that America has to face is defeating, is obliterating white supremacy from our culture.
Yeah, you know, my mom, I openly acknowledge that my ancestors fought against Native Americans in, you know, the what was called Lord Dunmore's War, the French and Indian Wars. My mom wrote, you know, did this family history, and so, you know, I know this. It's important to me to understand that, you know. So I, you know, she joined the Daughters of the American Revolution so she could access their library of like some of the best libraries, so she could do this family history research. She didn't really, you know, she's not really proud to be, you know, the descendant of someone who fought in those wars. But, you know, I can acknowledge that there's been a terrible mistakes made, that this history is not a good history, is not something that we should proudly, you know, continue. We should proudly claim, we should acknowledge that we've made mistakes and move on. You know, these alt-right, free speech rallies I was going to, Joey Gibson, I guess they just had one. I didn't go to that one. But, you know, I made a point to talk to some of these alt-righters, you know, the Proud Boys and some of them to try to understand. And like this, every time it comes down to some of the same things, is basically like this whole question of history.
Yeah.
It's always there. It's like they can't, I don't know if you ever saw this film, They Live. It's a ridiculous thing where, anyway, these aliens come.
Oh, yes, I've seen this film. Yeah, yeah.
That scene where Rodney, where they have this fight where he forces him to put on the glasses. That's like such a metaphor. Yeah, yeah. It's like people just refuse to look. They refuse to look and see.
This is part of the issue of a question about democracy, is that, you know, we are primates, and do we actually have the capacity to function democratically? You know, one of the things that that is really important about traditional communities and cultures is that they have social solutions and answers that no one else has, that are preserved. You know, the ideas of democracy and women's rights really come out of the interaction between the colonists and the Iroquois Confederacy. You know, and they stated, you know, if you read Benjamin Franklin's writings, he's very clear about it, that his, you know, he printed those treaties that were signed between the Pennsylvania and the Iroquois Confederacy. You know, he read the speeches that the Tadaho leaders gave at these meetings, and he reprints them, and he talks about them quite a bit in his writing, and is explicit about it, that this is our inspiration for our democracy, for our union, is the Iroquois Confederacy. You know, you learn from what you see around you. You know, the feudalism of Europe was an ocean away for these colonists. And so they, the idea of democracy, which ironically, of course, you know, these same alt-right folks are talking about, they're talking about the Constitution as a sacred document. You know, these are all inspired by indigenous political structures. And then, of course, the issue of women's rights, of course, is was inspired by Seneca women, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and all of those women who did the first women's rights conference in Seneca Falls in, I think, 1848. They are explicit that they were inspired by Seneca women. There's a Seneca village adjacent to Seneca Falls, the white town, and they observe that the difference in their status.
Again, that question of frame of reference, of having to see something different from...
What they think is American is actually indigenous. The things that they value, their rights, these are indigenous rights. Rights that they really did not have in Europe or in England. It's funny because I've been researching it a lot, the Constitution, because I've been dealing with the Bundy's interpretation of it. And also Bundy, the name Bundy, actually means bound, servant. Yeah, Bundy comes from being bound to the Lord, and he would give them some land to farm. And then after the Normans came, it actually turned into serfdom, actually, where they were, when the Lord would inherit the land, he'd inherit the Bundys, right? So their whole thing of them being a free people land is kind of ironic. And even the Mormon aspect, you know, the Mormons went to basically Dickensian England and recruited saints, you know, people there. And I was reading from the Manchester Saints stuff in London, and these are people who are working in the factories. They've been driven off the land because, of course, the commons had been closed, right? So they were driven to the factories because it's funny, the Quakers were big in that because they were like, if people have the commons and they can grow their own food and all this stuff and make, they'll be lazy and they won't go work in the factories. So they basically closed the commons, impoverished the people to the point where they had to go to workhouses and work for very little money, almost slave conditions in the factories. And it's from this group the Mormons actually proselytized. And that they actually got people to come over. And it's really sad. I mean, some of these people were starving. Like, they couldn't even keep each other alive, these Mormon saints in Manchester, England. They could not even have enough money to keep each other from starving to death. And this is why they came here to this country. This is why they pushed carts all the way across the Midwest, you know, into Utah, you know, and came here, and then eventually ended up in San Juan County. When Utah was declared a state, 30% of the population was born in England. That many of the, and so they really, Mormonism is, it has a deep connection to the Industrial Revolution and the impoverishment of the English people. And so
that's why they became super industrialists, the Mormons.
Yes.
Arms manufacturers.
Yes, yeah. So there's a whole history of that. But these ideals that the alt-right is supposedly espousing, these are indigenous ideals.
Wow, what a historical excursion. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you've been hearing Jacqueline Keeler, my guest host, on a monthly basis here this morning in the studio. Unfortunately, we did not have phones, so you could call in. Hopefully that will be resolved, hopefully for tomorrow's talk radio, but certainly by next Wednesday talk radio. So, yeah, you got your new book on the Bundys you got to finish here, and you've got these articles, which I've linked on our website, kbo.fm, about the bear's ears. We didn't even talk about the lawsuits. So there's a bunch of the Native Nations have filed a bunch of lawsuits.
Yeah, they are. And their legal wisdom says that the law is on their side. The law is very simply written. It's a very short law. You can read it. It's like just a few sentences long. And in no way does it give the president the right to reduce the size of the monuments, only to create them. Only Congress has the right to do that. But there is some indication that the Trump administration expects to lose this case because they actually put in a severability clause into the proclamation, which is normally only used in corporate contracts, but it was put in here, and which means that even if they lose on the issue of his ability to reduce the size of the monuments, everything else in the proclamation still stands, which includes the reduction of the Bears Ears Commission's oversight to just the area of Shasta.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for being with us again. Look forward to next month. This has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO provides free training in all aspects of operating a radio station. We're looking for people to join our community of volunteers by evaluating our on-air programs. We have an evaluation training on Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. at KBOO Studios, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This class teaches about the evaluation form and minute-per-minute form, music versus PA versus news program evaluation, and about objectivity and opinions relating to KBOO's mission, vision, programming charter. If you're interested, please RSVP by email to del@kboo.org. Again, that's Evaluating KBOO Programming, a training class taking place Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. here at your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Chamber Music Northwest and KBOO present Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tasloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Tasloff is a Hamburg-based violin player who is known as a performer who explores the limits of feelings and musical expression through the violin. This performance of Bach's masterpieces will feature the equivalent of two concerts with an extra-long intermission. Again, that's Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tasloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning for our news and public affairs strip this morning. Coming right up, it's Political Perspectives, today presenting Sojourner Truth Radio and a discussion with actor and filmmaker Bill Duke about his book and documentary Dark Girls, which explores colorism. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, as usual, with Dennis Bernstein. 11 o'clock brings us the Dirt Bag, today talking about soil tests, pH, and the new Temperate Orchard Conservancy. And please remember that KBOO keeps you informed, and it's possible for you to get involved. You can go to kboo.fm anytime and click on Donate to become